You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And actually, I should have printed out that New York Times article. Maybe you could track that thing down from over the weekend on how they've been planning this thing. Print it out for me so I can riff on it. Net here. The New York Times this weekend basically laid out how, in particular, David Koch, but presumably a few other billionaires are in on this, how the planning of the government shutdown was organized kind of along the same lines as the planning of 9/11. With 9/11, you had Osama bin Laden, who was a multimillionaire, in part because of all the money we gave him to fight the Russians, but in part because he came from a very, very wealthy oil family. And he had this guy, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who came to him and said, "Hey, I got an idea to hit America. You know, let's do it really, really big." There's even some debate whether Khalid Sheikh Mohammed even told him it was going to involve hijacking planes and flying them into buildings or not. The consensus seems to be that bin Laden knew that was going to happen. But this was a conversation that they had back in 99. So, you know, it took a couple of years. And bin Laden said, "Okay, fine, here's the money. You take care of the details." And so bin Laden put up the cash. And the details were handled by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who got together the 20 hijackers and most of them Saudis, like bin Laden was. And I don't know if Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was a Saudi or not. I'd have to go back and look. In any case, he put this thing together, and boom, it happened. And what was the goal of 9/11? The goal of 9/11 was basically to bring our government to its knees, to fundamentally change the nature and behavior of our government. Now, there's specific, bin Laden, if you go back to his 1998 New York Times article and interviews, the behavior that he specifically objected to was that we were defaming or desecrating, rather, the Saudi Arabia by having a U.S. Air Force base there, which was put there by George Herbert Walker Bush in order to fight against Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And we kept it there after the Gulf War was over. And that he felt that the price of oil was too low, that we were basically stealing the resources of his nation. But basically, the bottom line is, he didn't like what we were doing. He wanted to bring our government to his knees. Well, the New York Times now, Cheryl Gay Stolberg and Mike McIntyre report. This is October 5th, so it was Saturday's paper. Shortly after President Obama started his second term, a loose-knit coalition of conservative activists led by former Attorney General Edwin Meese III, gathered in the Capitol to plot strategy. Out of that session, held one morning in a location the members insist on keeping secret, no more reference to the caucus room restaurant, I think, is out of business, I'm not sure. Anyhow, out of that session, held one morning in a location the members insist on keeping secret, came a little-noticed, quote, "Blueprint to defunding Obamacare," end quote, signed by Mr. Meese and leaders of more than three dozen conservative groups. It articulated a take-no-prisoners legislative strategy. And Cheryl and Mike go on from there. Ed Meese, by the way, you will recall, back during the Reagan administration, was the attorney general. He convened the Meese Commission on Pornography to determine if pornography was destructive, if it warped our brains, if it turned us into zombies or robots. He personally watched hours and hours of pornography. And if my recollection at the time was correct, because there was a big kerfuffle about it, the pornography that his commission was examining included child pornography and snuff pornography and, violence, snuff, murder, pornography that involves murder. And, all these kinds of just really over-the-top porn. So Ed Meese is, looking at all this porn. And he came to the conclusion that, yes, in fact, pornography does warp your brain. That's the guy who convened the meeting. Michael Meneedham, who runs Heritage Action for America, which is the Heritage Foundation's political arm, he said in the New York Times, to a New York Times reporter, quote, "We felt very strongly at the start of this year that the House needed to use the power of the purse. From the start, this was a fight we were going to pick." No, really. Ed Meese is not in political office, and to the best of my knowledge, and neither is Michael Meneedham. But they're well-financed by the billionaires. See, I keep telling you, this is a war between the billionaires who have health insurance, Michael Meneedham, who has health insurance, Ed Meese, who has health insurance, and the rest of us. They worked with members of the Tea Party caucus in Congress, who all have health insurance, who are excited about drawing a red line against the law they despise. Groups like Tea Party Patriots, Americans for Prosperity, and FreedomWorks were all immersed in the fight, as is Club for Growth. Some like Generation Opportunity and Young Americans for Liberty are upstarts. Heritage Action is new, too. The billionaire Koch brothers, Charles and David, have been deeply involved with financing the overall effort. A group linked to the Kochs, Freedom Partners Chamber of Commerce, disbursed more than $200 million last year to nonprofit organizations involved in the fight. We're talking about this fight to defund Obamacare by bringing the government to its knees. $200 million? Included was $5 million to Generation Opportunity, which created a buzz last month with an internet ad. Remember Uncle Sam with a speculum and the gloved finger? Burning phony Obamacare cards, creating sample tweets and Facebook posts that you too can use. Then came the Senate Conservatives Fund. Some, like the Koch-financed Americans for Prosperity, which spent $5.5 million on healthcare television advertisements over the past 3 months, are more focused on sowing public doubts. But they all have a common denominator, which is to cripple a measure that Senator Ted Cruz, a Texas Republican, has likened to a horror movie. So, Bin Laden pays for it, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed does it, or puts it together, and then his suicide band fly into buildings, and in one case, into the ground. Charles and David Koch fund it. Ed Meese and Meneedham and Heritage and all these right-wing groups execute it and fund it, and they put their guy in charge of getting the suicide bombers. The suicide bombers are the 30 or so members of the Tea Party caucus in the House of Representatives. The Khalid Sheikh Mohammed for this deal is Ted Cruz. Right? Ted Cruz is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He's the guy who is orchestrating the thing. He's not going to get his hands dirty. He's not the one who is the suicide bomber. Right? They're in the House of Representatives. He's in the Senate. And the suicide bombers are, sure enough, I mean, they're like kamikaze pilots. They're flying their planes into the decks of the USS United States of America, bringing down our country. Isn't that sweet? If you haven't read this article in the New York Times, on Saturday's New York Times, it's really worth reading. If you go to today's New York Times and just click on the most emailed, it's right up there at the top. It's titled, "A Federal Budget Crisis, Months in the Planning."
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And what do you call this when people plan to bring the government of the United States to its knees? In 2001, we called it terrorism. And welcome back. Andrew Campbell is with us. He's the senior producer with The Big Picture, our TV show that's on at 7 o'clock Eastern Time tonight here on Free Speech TV. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing?
Great. So we're going to start out, rants similar to what I was just ad-libbing here about the Taliban has finally shut down America. And then segue from that into the Supreme Court. So this is going to make it, the Supreme Court's picking up this case tomorrow that's going to make it even easier for the Koch brothers to buy American politicians.
Yeah, Koch brothers, Sheldon Adelson, they spent nearly $150 million in the 2012 election cycle. But if this new
that we case, know of.
That we know of. Obviously, there was millions thrown around behind the scenes. That's already way too much money. But this new case that's being taken up is called McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission. Like you said, it'll be heard tomorrow by the Supreme Court, and it could give billionaires even more power over our democracy. It's kind of hard to imagine that they could have even more power, but it's definitely possible with this case, and depending on how the right-wing justices on the court side.
That's absolutely incredible. That's absolutely incredible. And then we're going to get Jim Hightower is going to drop by.
Yeah, Jim Hightower is going to be on, and we're going to talk about Wendy Davis. People might remember that she is the state legislator, Democratic state legislator from Texas, who we couple
state senator.
State senator, yes. She held a filibuster a couple months back when the Texas legislature and Senate was considering a bill on abortion, a very strict bill. And she talked and talked and talked, and she gained a lot of attention with that and instantly gained tremendous progressive and Democratic support. And on Friday, she announced that she will be running for governor in Texas. Now there's a lot of talk. Could she really be the end to the old good be the end to the good old boys club in Texas and really break the Republican stranglehold on the state?
Yeah, very, very interesting. In the best of the rest, we're going to get into a discussion about the militarization of our police departments.
Yeah, we're going to have a panel. We're going to have Amy Goodman on and Matthew Feeney, and this is really spawning off of the events of last week here in D.C. When a woman was shot and killed by the Capitol Police after leading them on a car chase from the White House to the Capitol building. And there's been a lot of discussion that the Capitol Police, the actions that they took, and instead of shooting the car, they shot her. It's just really outrageous. It's a perfect example of how our police are turning into a military force.
Is Matthew Feeney, what's his position on this? Do you know?
I believe Matthew is against it.
Okay.
He doesn't really think that there's a large problem with the police in America today.
Oh, in other words, he's in support of the Capitol Police and what they did.
Yeah.
Okay, that's very interesting. All righty. And then what else is up?
Then
Everything
we'll,
You Know is Wrong?
Yeah, and Block D, we'll have our Everything You Know is Wrong segment. And just when you thought climate change couldn't cause anything else to go wrong, Americans love their oysters. They eat over 100 million pounds of them each year. But this new pathogen in the water and this being driven and fueled by climate change might bring an end to that. So we'll get into that.
Looks very, very interesting. And our Daily Take tonight.
And the Daily Take tonight will talk about how basically there's kings, warlords, and theocrats back running America.
Now, these are the three traditional, Thomas Jefferson identified these as the three traditional forms of tyranny over the minds of man.
Exactly.
Paraphrasing. And they're back.
Yep.
They are back. Andrew Campbell, senior producer of The Big Picture. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, Tom.
Great talking. We'll be back. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you in the place where despair is not an option, although we do like to point out that do you see this tomorrow? Shane is going to be there. Shane Farnan, who's you know running our board and our associate producer here, he is also a law school graduate. He is the Supreme Court reporter for the Talk Radio News Service. He's going to be there at SCROTUS tomorrow morning and listening to the initial arguments. Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Republicans in the Senate, is going to embarrass us all by going before the kings and queens of America, the Supreme Court justices, on bended knee and begging for the ability to take money directly from billionaires. Please overturn Buckley versus Vallejo. Strip all limits and protections away. Please let me be David Koch's own personal senator. Although I think Ted Cruz beat you to it, Mitch. But if they overturn this, the very last vestiges, I mean, they overturned corporations giving money to corporations doing political support. And so now we've got all these corporate forms, right? These PACs and super PACs and weird PACs and 501c4s and whatnot. They're all corporate forms. You have to kind of funnel the money through them. And there's still some rules on what they can do, what they can't do. But you can't just walk up to a politician and say, here's $1 million. Go kick that other guy's butt and win the election. That's the case tomorrow before the Supreme Court. Mr. McCutcheon, a southern right-wing, he describes himself as somewhere between a libertarian and a Republican. He was horrified to discover that he couldn't give all the money he wanted to his favorite political candidate, that there are still limits on the amount of money you can give to individual candidates and their campaigns. I think his name is Sean McCutcheon. And so Sean McCutcheon was complaining about this to a friend of his, and his friend said, well, why don't you sue? You can take it all the way to the Supreme Court. Get that law knocked down. And so he did, and they took the case, and it's now before the Supreme Court, and it is going to be argued tomorrow. We are seeing, right before our very own eyes, the disintegration of American democracy as we descend into oligarchy and chaos. And make no mistake about it, major political transitions are usually associated with times of chaos. And this major political transition that we're in the midst of right now is largely the consequence of the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision in 2010, saying that, ultimately ratifying that money is speech and corporations have protections under the Constitution. Under the Bill of Rights, the same as people. And so the result of this is this incredible twisting and distorting of our political system to the point where you now have politicians who are more interested in pleasing the billionaires and actually harming our country than you have politicians who are interested in doing what's the right thing for America and doing the thing that their constituents want. And increasingly, you also have an America where the, quote, what the constituents want part is the result of very, very carefully focused group, very finely tuned messages delivered in a giant echo chamber of right-wing radio, Fox News, the right-wing blogosphere and websites. You know, it echoes from the lips of Limbaugh to Drudge Report to Bill O'Reilly back to Limbaugh. You know, it's just this continuous echo. And Fox, you know, it's owned by a billionaire, right-wing billionaire. Rupert Murdoch, he was a very smart guy. If you want to watch MSNBC, you've got to pay a premium for that. It's an extra $5 a month or so, pretty much everywhere in the country. But Fox, they made the decision that they would take less money and have a bigger reach. There's no place in America where you can't get Fox. I mean, they may not be over the air. They're on cable, but they're also on satellite. Basic satellite. It's amazing. Over the weekend, Saturday, I turned on the TV and said, let's see what's going on in the news. Go to MSNBC. They're doing some sort of documentary on something. Caught by the camera. Police dash cams. But went to Fox. Fox is running Huckabee. And he's talking about how wonderful he is. He was the smartest guy ever. He was the longest elected Republican, blah, blah, blah. And I never did quite get the point except that he's smart and Obama's not. And then I flipped to CNN, and CNN was doing live coverage of the fact that we had just captured a terrorist in Libya and nearly killed or captured a terrorist in Somalia. Major operation. Not a word about it on Fox. And MSNBC was doing their pre-programmed programming. And I'm saying to myself, you know, Fox says they're America's news headquarters. For a lot of America, it's true. So you've got this right-wing echo chamber that is bouncing around the messages from, you know, billionaire Rupert Murdoch and billionaire David Koch and billionaire Shelley Adelson and the small hand, you know, and billionaire Wall Street, the Wall Street billionaires, the Pete Petersons and whatnot, and all of their minions, all the people that they pay very well, they pay them a couple $100,000, $1 million a year to say what needs to be said. So they come on as guests on these networks and they bounce this stuff around and they write the columns and they write the books and the books, you know, they get them on the New York Times list by buying thousands of copies in bulk and et cetera, et cetera. And the message gets out. And so the people think, hey, this is the best thing. We shouldn't have health insurance. Amazing button collection over at the Democratic Underground this morning. The top one was, all three had the Republican logo. The top one said, stop socialism. Stop Social Security. It was from 1935. Next one was, stop socialism. Stop Medicare. It's from 1965. And the third one, of course.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And the third one, of course, was, stop socialism. Stop Obamacare. From right now. These are turning point things. This is major stuff that's going on. Back with your calls. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And by the way, greetings to WBAI in New York City and KABU in Portland, Oregon. We are going on both stations today. It's really cool. Along with KPFK in Los Angeles and KBCS in Seattle. I mean, we're building our, and a number of others as well, building our Pacifica infrastructure here. It's really, really cool. So anyhow, welcome back to the program and to your calls. Diana in Portland, Maine. Hey, Diana, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Actually, I'm in Poland, Maine.
Poland. I'm sorry.
Could I preface my question with mentioning that all through school, we were taught that three forms, our form of government with its three branches was the ideal form because each one of the branches kept an eye on the other two.
Correct.
Well, we're here in a mess where a small mafiosi of bozos has taken over the entire government. My question is, how come this doesn't happen in the EU and Great Britain?
Because those
various parliamentary forms of government.
Right. In the European countries, there is no European country that has a form of government where their unelected judiciary can establish law. The Supreme Court in England does not have the kind of powers, the judicial review powers that they do in the United States. Actually, in Germany, there is a court called the Constitutional Court where issues of constitution go, which is different from their Supreme Court. But even that court has only a very limited ability to they can't change legislation. They can only interpret things in the context of, legislation in the context of the Constitution. So really the problem that we have here in the United States, the big problem that we have here in the United States, goes back to 1803. And in 1803, there was a case called Madison versus Marbury, where the United States Supreme Court ruled for the very first time ever, and in a way that is not explicated, it's not written down in the Constitution, that the court, that the United States was essentially a constitutional monarchy. We were not a democratic republic. And that the justices on the court had the function of monarchs. In many countries, monarchs can strike down laws, they can make laws, and you know, thus influence the course of government. And so the court said that, you know, that they could strike down a law, and what they struck down was the Federal Judiciary Act of 1798, as I recall, and that they had the power to do that. And that has extended all the way to today. I mean, they only did it twice in the first half of the 19th century, that case in Dred Scott, but that worked out real well. But he says facetiously, it caused the Civil War. But now the court does almost nothing but this. It does almost nothing but determine which laws are good and which laws are bad. That is not a function given to the UN, to the Supreme Court in the Constitution. And so you take that and add to it the fact that this court has said that the protections of free speech enshrined in the First Amendment, extend not just to words we say, but to money we have in our pocket. That money is the same thing as speech. Spending money is functionally the same thing as speaking, number one. And number two, that the protections of persons, the protection against unreasonable search and seizure, the protection of privacy, the protection, most importantly, of having the right to speak out on public issues, particularly political public issues, those rights are not just for human beings, but also for corporations. The Supreme Court has come up with these two doctrines. There is, to the best of my knowledge, no other sophisticated democracy in the world that has this. The only other country that I know has this in their constitution is the country of South Africa. And what we're watching right now, what we've seen, and the reason why, by the way, is because when the apartheid regime fell, a number of American corporations, very high-profile American corporations, sent free lawyers over to South Africa and helped them write their constitution. And they wrote into the constitution that corporations are persons and money is speech. Just wrote it right into their constitution. And I think this is one of the big problems that we're seeing in South Africa right now, is that the oligarchs are taking over again. And poverty is increasing, and, you know, as predictably. So that, you know, Diana, that's essentially what's going on. And until we reverse that, either the power of the Supreme Court, which would take an act of Congress under Article 3, Section 2, they have that power to simply, Congress could pass a law tomorrow saying that the Supreme Court does not have the right of judicial review. They do not have the authority to overturn laws passed by Congress. And then the Supreme Court could try to say, oh, that's an unconstitutional law you just passed. And, you know, it's very interesting to game that out, where that would end up. Odds are, though, that the Supreme Court said that the executive branch would end up basically making the decision, because as Andrew Jackson demonstrated when he refused to follow a Supreme Court ruling with regard to the Trail of Tears back in the 1830s, the Supreme Court has no power of enforcement. So they can talk all day long. If the executive branch, which has the power of enforcement, does or doesn't go along with it, then that's what's going to happen. So, yes, go ahead.
Still, they have that power, the executive branch.
Yes, this is the way our government is set up. The Congress does not have police other than for their own building. Does not have police powers. They don't have enforcement powers. They just basically can appropriate funds and pass laws. The Supreme Court has no police powers either. They have no enforcement powers. They rule on cases. All of the power, the enforcement power, the police agencies, the FBI, the military, the federal police, all of those powers, where the actual power of, you know, guys with guns in jails and things, that's all in the executive branch. The executive branch can't make laws, but the executive branch is tasked with carrying out and executing the laws. And it does not say in the Constitution that the executive branch has to execute laws as interpreted by the Supreme Court. It does not say that. The Supreme Court said that. And so the executive branch, if they refuse to do that, which is exactly what Andrew Jackson did in, as I recall, my recollection is, it was either 1834 or 1838, when the Supreme Court said, you may not move those Indians from Georgia to Oklahoma, which we call the Trail of Tears. And Andrew Jackson said, you know, old John Marshall has made his ruling, let him enforce it. He laughed. He laughed in the face of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and he moved the Indians out to Oklahoma. And the Supreme Court had, you know, they're impotent. There was nothing they could do. And there was no, and they have no mechanism to come back against Andrew Jackson. And Andrew Jackson was, you know, widely applauded for standing up to the Supreme Court. Abraham Lincoln tried to stand up to the Supreme Court in a somewhat similar way. And Franklin Roosevelt tried to actually regulate the court. He tried to change the number of justices on the court because they were not ruling the way that he liked. But that's our problem in the United States, is that all of these European countries, many of them are actually constitutional monarchies. You know, you've got the Queen of England. The Queen of England has the power to dissolve Parliament, but she does not have the power to strike down a law. You got the Queen of Holland and Queen and King of Holland. They have the power to dissolve Parliament. They don't have the power to strike down a law. Ditto for Sweden and Denmark. And, I mean, there's a bunch of constitutional monarchies. Their monarchs don't have as much power as our Supreme Court does. And that is the original. It was a tiny cancer cell in 1803, and now it's a full-blown metastasis here in the United States right now. Diana, thank you for the call. Patty in Harstene Island, Washington.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for listening to KBCS. What's up?
Well, what's up is I wrote you a little poem.
Okay.
And it goes something like this. I do not like their brand of tea. I do not like it at all, you see. I do not think it likely to be any good for you or me. They take the ball so none can play. They close the playground till another day. They stop all fun until you say that we will play, but only their way. They invited them into the house to dine. They invited them into the house to waste time. And now the Republicans will become toast, for the invited baggers will eat their hosts.
The tea baggers are going to eat their hosts. That's a good one, Patty.
Yeah, and, well, you know, I'm wondering, I know about the movement to try to get Citizens United changed, but I'm wondering if the regular old-time Republicans realize that, you know, their biscuits are on the line, too.
Oh, they do. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce just came out and said that in the next election cycle in 2014, those kind of old-fashioned John McCain-type Republicans who are not doing the Tea Party thing, they will fund their campaigns against Tea Party challenges. They've said enough is enough. We're, you know, this is not good for business. I don't know where the stock market is at right now. It opened 100 points down this morning. It's probably still down a bit. If this gets much worse, it's going to get a whole lot worse. And so you've got the, I mean, traditionally from around the 1870s until about three or four years ago, the Republican Party was pretty much entirely and typically fairly proudly the party of business, the party of the of wealthy people, but it was a kind of a upper middle class kind of wealthy people, you know, not the plutocrats, but the wealthy people and the businesses, small businesses all the way to large businesses. But the Tea Party, which has taken a good chunk of the Republican Party, this is a party of, by and for, a very small group of libertarian, Ayn Rand, objectivist-oriented who philosophically disagree with the very idea of governance itself, people, billionaires, who are bent on essentially transforming America into, in my opinion, into Somalia, because I know of no developed nation in the world that doesn't have a social safety net. Patty, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's the place where smart people get their news. We'll be back with more of the news of the day, my thoughts and your thoughts on my thoughts on your thoughts. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ryan in Spokane, Washington. Hey, Ryan. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the Obamacare. Earlier, you were comparing Senator Ted Cruz to a terrorist.
Yeah, to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
Right. Okay, that's fine. He's a terrorist. I find that that's a little bit extreme. I find that all the talking.
Of course it is. It's hyperbolic. Extreme. I was using an extreme example to make my point.
Right, exactly. But that's the problem. That's all anybody does anymore. And
yeah,
just because somebody disagrees with your point doesn't make them a Republican or a Tea Party advocate. It just makes them maybe independently thinking. I've been that way my whole life.
No, I'm sorry. Here you've got a guy who has no skin in the game. Ted Cruz is in the Senate. The House is what's bringing down this country. The suicide bombers are in the House. And they are suicide bombers. I mean, they're willing to go down in flames themselves, although I think that they all believe that the billionaires will back them in their reelection campaigns, and this is going to help them. But they're willing to take down the whole country with them. Ted Cruz is orchestrating this thing. He has more power right now than John Boehner, than the Speaker of the House, because he controls that Tea Party caucus. And Ted Cruz, go back and look at the money that got him elected. Ted Cruz is the invention of billionaires.
Well, trust me, nobody's happy that the Koch brothers are even getting involved in it. But there's no grassroots program, period, on the left or the right, where the money and the people with the money don't come in and try to mess with it.
I know, and this is the point that I made about 15, 20 minutes ago about how our Supreme Court has screwed this thing up so badly. They've just totally royally screwed the pooch, as the old saying goes.
Both sides. sides. And Barack Obama has no problem raising more money than Republicans. So,
exactly, because the Supreme Court has said that. Because the Supreme Court has said that money is the same thing as speech. Yes, you're right.
I did want to originally call just to talk about health care a little bit. This is basically a tax. The Supreme Court said it is a tax. It was the only way that they could pass it. The problem with the tax is it hurts the poor. Trust me, I could prove to you with a phone number and a phone call that my business that has probably about 60 employees is going to be hurt. Our hours will be cut as soon as the implementation is.
Oh, I agree with you, Ryan. I agree with you. Hang on just a second, Ryan. I totally agree with you. Because Obamacare, because they moved back the exchanges for small businesses and for large businesses, for that matter, because they moved that back by a year, our health insurance rates are going to go up. And we're looking at maybe somewhere between 20 and 30% increases in insurance. My company. I know over at RT that they're looking at a 34% increase. I mean, businesses around the country are looking at substantial increases because President Obama did not force the implementation of the business side of this. And so the health insurance companies are saying, hey, we're going to squeeze as much as we can out of these businesses. We got one more year to do it. And I'm very unhappy about that. And we're having to look at, you know, what are we going to do? Because, it's a tough one. It's going to be a tough one for all businesses. But that's not because of Obamacare. If there had been no Obamacare at all, I suspect we'd be looking at even higher increases because the insurance companies would be able to get away with anything. At least now, the money that they can skim off the top is capped at 80%, which includes for businesses. So, Ryan, the problem is the system. It's not Obamacare. We'll be back. Welcome back, Tom. I'm here with you. And Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman, just a quick question and hoping to follow up with a bumper sticker after your answer. All right, you just asked us, what do we call this? What the politicians who are indebted to the billionaires, you called it terrorism. Could it be considered?
No, I didn't call it terrorism. I drew an analogy between the structure of the terrorist organization and the structure of the Tea Party, but I didn't call them terrorists.
Okay, well, could it be considered treason? That's all I wanted to know.
No. And I don't think that, and this is why I didn't call them terrorists either, I don't think that those words should lose their meaning. I think that just like I don't think the word Holocaust should lose its meaning. Ted Cruz compared Obamacare to Hitler and the Nazis and the Holocaust and his floor speech. I think that was a mistake. I think that's hyperbole that actually damages the language. I was making this metaphorical analogy, I suppose, whatever structural analogy, to how Bin Laden funded it, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed did it without getting his hands dirty, and then the suicide bombers went down in flames. And I see the same thing between the billionaires funding it and Ted Cruz, you know, pulling the strings in the Senate, and then the guys in the House of Representatives who are doing what Ted Cruz tells them to do, taking down the whole House of Representatives with them, and possibly the entire Republican Party. But I wouldn't call it treason. I wouldn't. But you had a bumper sticker idea?
Yeah, that sort of screws up my bumper sticker. It was going to be, if you agreed with that it was treason, money does not grow on treason.
Money does not grow on treason. It would be a good one. You know, I still remember John Stormer's book that he published back in the early 60s. I read it when I was a teenager, and it really changed my life. It turned me into a radical Republican for about 6 months. And it was called None Dare Call It Treason, and it was about how the communists had infiltrated the State Department. And I think None Dare Call It Treason would be with maybe the Republican logo or the upside down stars or something next to it would be a really interesting bumper sticker. Problem is, it's subtle enough. Most people wouldn't get it. But anyhow, Michael, thanks. That's an interesting idea. Tony in Stafford, Virginia. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Yeah, Mike, I got a problem with that tape. You know, we were showing about those World War II veterans at the memorial.
Yeah.
Yeah. What camera crew or news crew had to send a crew there and watch them?
Well, there were a couple of Republican members of Congress, Michelle Bachmann and I forget who else, who had notified the media that they were going to go down there and help the World War II veterans get into the thing. So,
yeah,
you know,
why didn't that organization postpone it? Because the shutdown wasn't anything new. It was like,
you know, Tony, I'm really conflicted about this one because, I mean, I live here in D.C. and I see these monuments and they're beautiful things and they're outdoors and they don't, you know, I realize you want to have staff people around to pick up the trash. You want to have staff people around in case somebody gets hurt. You want to make sure that the place is respected, those kinds of things. Although there are still park police. I mean, now they're enforcing you can't get into the monument. I think that that might be a big strategic mistake on the part of the Obama administration. On the other hand, just like I think it was a mistake that they closed the White House to the tours, these World War II vets, you know, a lot of these people have probably made these plans for 2, 3, 4 years. They've been setting aside, you know, $25 a month. Out of their Social Security, my heart goes out to them. I think it's really sad that they're being played by these, you know, Republican members of Congress who are grandstanding for the cameras. And, you know, but this is just what happens. I don't see clear good guys, bad guys here. But I do see the clown show going on. But I would not say to the World War II vets, hey, you should have just canceled your trip. A lot of these people won't be alive next year, and many of them know it. Tony, thanks for the call. Caleb in Lake Oswego, Oregon. Hey, Caleb, what's up?
Yeah, you know, sir, I had the same idea that you did when I read that article about the cabal of folks and saying, you know, when we listen to the national media, we think, oh, they stumbled into it, you know, shutting down. But I absolutely correct about the Koch brothers and stuff. Did you read that article in the New York Times yesterday that Daniel Goleman wrote?
What was the topic?
Rich just do care less.
Really? No, but I didn't read that. But I can tell you that there's been a whole it's become like a subset of the science of psychiatry and psychology about how when you become wealthy, it rewires your, and particularly if you're born into wealth, your brain is actually wired different than other people. You're less capable of feeling empathy.
No, you keep saying that, Tom, and I'm glad you're absolutely correct. You're ahead of the curve on so many things. But this article, really, Goleman could have been listening to you from day one and gone through the thing. And also remember, last week the woman came up with the idea, the word sedition rather than treason, and you kind of liked it. Don't
yes.
you think these guys are seditious?
Yeah, and I should have said that when the guy called earlier with treason. Thank you for reminding me of that, Caleb, because I do think it's seditious what they're doing.
And I'm looking forward to you on KABU here.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Great.
Thanks a lot, Caleb. Good talking with you. And Steve in River Forest, Illinois. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. A while back, you expressed a wish that somebody would write a song on the issue of corporate personhood.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote one. I wrote one, and I posted it on your website. It's a free download.
Oh, cool.
You just need to go to the contacts page and then the section that shows music suggestions.
Uh-huh.
I just posted it. I posted it yesterday.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Thank you, Steve.
Sure.
Appreciate that. Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle. Mark, we got a minute. You wanted to talk about the effect of the government shutdown on journalists?
Yes, I'm trying to cover up on the story, the West Fertilizer plant explosion that killed 15 people in Texas in April.
Right.
And the Texas authorities haven't been able to determine a cause, so it's been turned over to the Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board, which is a federal agency. But unfortunately, that office is closed today, and it's been closed since the government shutdown, so there are no federal employees right now working on investigating any toxic spills or any accidents that have happened in the past or that would be happening this week. And the current investigation on the West fertilizer plant explosion is now frozen. So the result for me and other journalists, by the way, who are trying to follow up on these kinds of stories, is that we can't file our story. And I think it's
amazing.
Story that the news media hasn't really been covering.
So if you own a paper mill or a refinery or any kind of operation that, you know, heavily pollutes the air or the water, this is a great week to dump your toxins.
Yes, definitely. And I also want to say Free Speech Radio News went off the air last Friday. And I want to give a shout out to everybody, hoping it'll come back soon.
Yeah, it's a good organization. I agree. Thank you, Mark.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And I have been saying for some weeks now, if you've been watching or listening to this program on a regular basis, you know this well, that what we are seeing played out right now has very little to do with Obamacare. It has very little to do with Republicans or Democrats. It even arguably has very little to do with billionaires and poor people. What it has to do with is two fundamentally different visions of America. One vision of America is the one by which this country was founded, where George Washington signed legislation into place establishing poorhouses, where poor people could be fed, sheltered, clothed, and provided with free medical services. George Washington. And then John Adams did it. And then Thomas Jefferson did it. And then during the James Madison presidency, Congress proposed that this should be done by the churches instead. And that was the first veto of the James Madison presidency. And he gave a long speech. You can read the veto message online. It's fairly easy to find, where he said that this would establish a horrible precedent, that caring for the poor is clearly a function of government, and that government should not be doing it via the churches. So there's that traditional vision of America, that there should be a social safety net, that there's a bottom through which we don't let each other fall, versus the libertarian vision of America that says, you're on your own, buddy. And that's why these guys are so afraid of Obamacare going into law, is if Obamacare goes into law, that's one step further into the what you might call democratic socialist vision or regulated capitalism vision, as opposed to the laissez-faire libertarian vision of America. I really see this as a battle of worldviews. Nick Gillespie is with me. He's the editor-in-chief of Reason.com and Reason TV, co-author of The Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America, Reason.com, of course, the website. Hey, Nick, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom, and also thanks for recasting American history with the founders as democratic socialists. That's an interesting.
Was it not true what I just said?
Well, I think the idea that there is a social safety net that government might provide, equating democratic socialism or even being anti-libertarian, is a stretch. Actually, yeah, and I don't think.
Tell me what I said that was wrong.
What I'm saying is that the idea that you would provide a social safety net for people is not the same thing as democratic socialism. It is not necessarily antithetical to libertarianism, at least not as I see it. And most important, it has nothing to do with opposition to Obamacare, which is actually, I can tell you right now that my opposition to Obamacare is not that it's going to work too well, but rather that it's going to increase everybody's costs over time and diminish everybody's social welfare.
Well, if it does, then we will vote the bums out and
we will change it, will we not? We won't, because it's much more difficult to do that. Medicaid is a good example of a program where every state in the country, Medicaid is, for listeners who are not certain of this, Medicaid is the government-provided health care for the poor in all 50 states. It is either the highest or second highest budget item on every state in the country's budget. They spend more and more money on it, and it has terrible health outcomes for poor people. There are clearly better alternative ways to deliver health care.
Well, let's talk about that for a second if you want. I'd rather keep this at 30,000 feet, but I can't just let that go unchallenged. First of all, the reason Medicare is exploding is because 32 years of Reaganomics has exploded poverty in the United States, and you know, and then the great Bush crash. So there are more people who have been thrown into the rolls of the poor and thus qualifying for Medicare. Thus, you've got a programming crisis, number one. Number two, you've got all these Republican states that are not taking federal dollars for Medicare. And number three, and I think the most important thing, whether if you want to talk about whether Medicare is working or is good or is bad or whatever, is that over at United Healthcare, a for-profit insurance company, you've got Stephen J. Hemsley skimming $1 billion off the top and putting it in his own personal pocket for his, what, five or seven homes and, you know, all around the world.
Okay,
and you've got over 100 executives making over $1 million a year. Medicaid is running on a 3% budget. And so, you know, it may not be perfect, but it's a hell of a lot better than this for-profit system that you guys push.
No, actually, it isn't. And again, the point is, if you know, even the Oregon study, which was widely touted as showing that Medicaid is a good idea, showed that there was no health benefit from being on Medicaid. So
there is a clear health detriment to not having it.
There are precious few services, goods and services, when they are directly provided by the government or directly paid for by the government, that get better. Would it be better? And let me ask you this, because
so you'd rather have Blackwater running your local police department?
No. What I'm saying is that do you agree with me? And this might be a point of actual commonality. There should not be food stamps in America. We should not be demeaning and humiliating poor people by saying you're poor, so we're going to give you fake dollars that you can spend on certain types of food that we deem edible by poor people. Wouldn't it be better to give people cash assistance as opposed to telling them what they have to pay for and where they have to go in order to buy it?
If you did that, you would have – that would be the end of the program. Because if you did that, you would have people showing up at the store and buying liquor and alcohol, and not everybody – it would be, you know, the small 2, 3, 4, 5%. And then the minute that happens, Fox News would be there with a camera crew, and it would be such a scandal, and that would kill the program. You know, come on, Nick, you can't be that politically naive.
No, I'm not being naive at all. What I'm saying is that I think that we should treat people who are...
I think we should do what Thomas Paine proposed in Agrarian Justice, that everybody in the country should have a minimum income.
Yeah, well, no, you know what? Actually, the whole point of a minimum income, the last great kind of declaration of that actually came from Milton Friedman, the free market libertarian Nobel Prize winning economist who floated it during the Nixon years.
Well, it was Hayek who said that a country, you know, if for a country to function, it has to have a national health care system. It was Hayek.
It doesn't have to have a national health care system.
Read Hayek. I should have printed the damn thing out for you. I can send it to you. But it's Friedrich Hayek said this is an appropriate function of government to run a national health care system.
As long as we're talking about areas of commonality, I would be totally happy. And even people like Charles Murray of all types have talked about, you know, give people a guaranteed minimum income, and then that's the beginning and the end of transfer programs. But it would actually be much better, because then you wouldn't have a system of nationalized or government-run health care versus private sector.
Well, Switzerland is voting on that for the next month, you know.
What's that?
Switzerland's voting on that next month.
Yeah, good. All I'm saying.
And Alaska does it to a certain extent.
You
know, when Sarah Palin was governor of Alaska, every year she wrote a check for a little over $2,000 to every man, woman, and child in the state. And that was because they were simply charging for the oil that was being pumped out of the ground in Alaska. Why don't we do this nationwide?
I know very few libertarians who would be against that. If it came with the proviso, then that gets rid of all other transfer programs, including things like Social Security or Medicare, health care for the old to wealthy.
Well, in that case, it would have to be more like $2,000 a month instead of $2,000 a year.
It would not be, you know, basically, actually, $1,000 a month to each individual would raise everybody in the country to the poverty level.
Sure.
And it would be cheaper than what we're doing now. It would end all kinds of bureaucratic nightmares and screw-ups, and it would also give each individual more options and more choices to figure out what they actually...
I don't think anybody in this country can live on $12,000 a year.
You've got to be kidding me. If there are three people in a household in an apartment and they're each making 12 grand a year, you couldn't live on that?
I would have a hard...
The poverty line in America is basically around, you know, it's around $11,000. It changes depending on the state and the area. It's more in Alaska and Hawaii, but that's the official government policy.
Yeah. I don't think having a, you know, going back to the Victorian era as a model where we have a huge class of working poor, a relatively small middle class and a small elite is a good vision. But Nick Gillespie, editor-in-chief of Reason.com. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back in just a moment. But which vision of America? I mean, we really are genuinely seeing a battle between these two visions for America. Which do you think is going to prevail? Welcome back. Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I haven't heard any of the people on TV mention
that. Ed, your phone is breaking up so badly I cannot understand you. I literally can't understand the words that you're saying. I'm going to hang you up and just try to call me right back,
hello.
Okay? Hello?
Hey. Hello?
Yeah, okay, that's smooth
hey,
now.
Phones. Okay. Tom, I haven't heard anybody mention that Congress can profit enormously and legally by crashing the government into the debt ceiling and ruining our credit rating and on our U.S. government bonds.
How do they do that? They all buy into a VXX or a hedge fund?
Sell bonds short. That's all you have to do is call your broker and say you want to sell U.S. government bonds short.
Yeah, well, that's VXX is selling the stock market short. And you know, it's like I haven't looked at VXX to see what it's doing, but that's my bellwether of you know, if VXX goes up, I start thinking, uh-oh. And I'm sure there are bond funds that are the same thing, you know, selling, you could short sell bonds.
But to have
the entire government short sell, but first of all, if the word got out that the government was short selling its own bonds, that would be a disaster. Secondly, to have the government short sell its own bonds, you know, this is like the bankers who did mortgages and then sold bets that the mortgages would fail. I mean, isn't that, morally reprehensible?
Of course it's morally reprehensible, but they got away with it, didn't they?
Well, there is that. There is that. But I don't think that just because somebody gets away with something that means that, you know, we should use it as a model or we should emulate it. I don't think they should have gotten away with it. And frankly, some of them may not get away
with it.
Pardon?
Good possibility they're doing it. Not that it's a good thing, but that they're doing it anyway.
Well, the Treasury doesn't speculate in currencies or treasuries. They just...
Not the Treasury, individual congressmen and their staff.
I guarantee you, Ed, that individual Congress members, they can legally trade on inside information. There is no doubt in my mind that 5 minutes before John Boehner went on national television and said, I see a default coming, that probably half the Republican caucus bought VXX or some other similar short fund.
You don't have to buy a fund. You can call your broker and sell U.S. Treasury bonds short.
Yeah. Yeah. It's easy. It's easy to do it through a fund, but you can do it yourself, too. Yeah, you're right. And I
have to wonder, can you become a member of an unpaid member of a congressional staff, say a billionaire become an unpaid member of the congressional staff and then profit from the same information legally?
There is a mechanism. And I'm sorry, Ed, that I don't remember the details of it, but there is a mechanism whereby somebody associated with a member of Congress can get information from that member of Congress and trade on it, and it is not considered an inside trade. But I don't, but there's a fair amount of nuance associated with it. And I don't remember the details. So this is one of Matt Taibbi's pieces in Rolling Stone a couple of years back. But it's probably a fairly common practice. I mean, you know, who knows?
Whoa.
So, yeah. I mean, you know, Tom DeLay actually had guys in his, when he was Speaker of the House, he actually had guys in his office doing day trading based on legislation that was coming before the House every single day. And, Tom DeLay is a multimillionaire now. And he was, what, a school teacher, wasn't he? Or no, he was a bug exterminator. He was an insect exterminator before when he went off to Congress. And he's now a multimillionaire. Go figure. Thanks, Ed. 20 minutes past the hour. So you figure, like last time around, Eric Cantor is shorting bonds. What do you want to bet? Bad pun. All righty. Tom in Woodridge, Illinois. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Big fan of the show.
Sure.
Listen, I'm a union steward for Teamsters Local 703, and we had organized a big cereal company. And we got everything together. Now we're ready to go and vote on the 11th, which is supposed to be this Friday. But I've been informed that the government shutdown has trickled down to us, and there's nobody available from the NLRB to be there for the vote. So
is the vote going to be postponed? So you have unionized or are in the process of unionizing one of the big cereal breakfast food manufacturers, and the vote is supposed to be this Friday, but because the National Labor Relations Board is out of business with the government shutdown, are you guys going to postpone the vote, or are you going to hold it without NLRB supervision?
No, because we need the NLRB supervision to actually sanction the vote, or else the company could come back and say it was an unfair labor practice and be able to charge against us.
So
we can't do that, but it trickled down to us, and it's hurt us, because now that's 300, and you know how hard it is to organize these days with the right-wing propaganda.
Oh, yeah.
This is 360 pension-paying members that we need to keep the pension funded and to keep all of us working and be able to retire.
Yeah.
So it trickled all the way down to us.
Amazing. Tom, thanks for the heads up on that. That's very bad news and another example of why it's very stupid politics to shut the government down. Katie in Pensacola, Florida. Hey, Katie, what's up?
Hi, Katie. Yes, that's Katie. I'm not talking to Hartman. Who did I talk to now?
Yeah, you're on the air. I'm Tom Hartman. You're Katie, and we are talking. You wanted to talk about the government?
Yes. First of all, I'm a widow of a man what was 41 years in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm speaking up now. I would like to know who appointed Israel to rule America. I would like to know that. I'm looking for an answer. I called my government away for 13 years. We had recently a town hall meeting. They connected me in order to listen in and to vote on who is the reason why we are now in a jam, or matter of fact, in a deficit.
Mm-hmm.
We borrow money. Why do we borrow money?
We borrowed money because George W. Bush fought two wars and did not put them on the federal budget. And so, and George Bush gave a massive tax cut to millionaires and billionaires and did not put that on the budget. And if you look at the federal, you know, budget deficit right now, what you find is that the vast majority of that federal budget deficit is from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the Bush tax cuts. And now, of course, from the lack of revenues coming from the great Bush recession. So, and who ran up the biggest deficits and who was responsible for the biggest increases in spending over the last 50 years, actually over the last 100 years, in every case with the exception of World War II, if you want to go back to the last 100 years, it has been Republican administrations. So, Katie, that's where I would begin. But, you know, if you want to departisanize in it, the question is, you know, who appointed these guys? If you're talking by these guys, you mean the billionaires who are pulling the puppet strings behind the Tea Party. It was the Supreme Court who appointed them. Thanks for the call, Katie. Frank in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Frank.
There sure seems to be a lot of legalized bribery going on out there. But follow me now. You know, the government shutdown had made it impossible for President Obama to travel for a Pacific Rim economic conference in Indonesia.
So China's running the show basically right now.
Or a East Asian security conference in Brunei this week. You know, maybe we don't realize it, but the world leaders are watching our political confusion on the right. You know, what if the shutdown isn't about affordable health care? What if it's to make the U.S. economy appear unstable so China can go to these conferences as a world leader the USA used to be? You know, because of the Supreme Court, Citizens United legislation from the bench, no one is really sure where all the bribes are coming from. For all we know, Ted Cruz could be a wholly owned subsidiary of the communist Chinese with orders to bring down our economy.
You know, you're absolutely right. There is sufficient opacity in the system that the United States Supreme Court has established in their infinite wisdom, that it could be, it's extremely unlikely. And there's a fair amount of campaign contribution information that is publicly available. But Shelley Adelson, for example, who kept, was it Newt or was it, which one of the characters, those primary, or was it Ricky Santorum? Shelley Adelson was funding one of those guys, you know, and just, you know, kept him going and going and going and going and going, this billionaire. And Shelley Adelson makes his money in casinos in Macau, which is part of China. So, you know, Chinese money supporting a Republican who, you know, wanted to be president of the United States. At a certain point, you scratch your head and say, really? Really? This is the United States? This really? This is what the Supreme Court has brought us to? I'm with you, Frank. Mike in Whitestone, New York. Hey, Mike.
How are you doing?
Good.
Tom, I love your show. It's great. I learn a lot from it.
Thanks.
You know, and I, too bad you can't get to a lot of these southern states where they absolutely know nothing what's going on. And it could be.
Well, we're on a lot of them on Dish, and, Dish TV and DirecTV in a lot of rural areas. But, Mike, we just have a half a minute.
My comment is on the guy from the insurance company I called. The guy to put Obamacare together worked for Humana for like 17 years. I forget his name. But he said, all the insurance companies, bottom line is profit. They're making over 30%. And this is a Republican plan. People don't know it, and people don't say enough about it. This is a Republican plan, and insurance companies are running it, just like Medicare Part D. And I don't know why the Democrats don't say that or push it or anything and push for
single. Well, because there's a back door in Obamacare that does allow for single payer, and Vermont is going to do it starting in 2016. Obamacare actually is, as the right wing is horrified by and they like to say, but it actually is a step down the road, should the American people decide that they want it, toward either socialized or single payer medicine. It is, or it could be. Let's say it could be a step down the road. And, you know, I think that that's a good thing that we're taking the step down that road. So, but, you know, over the short term, it's going to cause a lot of pain. Mike, thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, is Ted Cruz the modern Taliban? Is the Tea Party the modern Taliban? Twenty-eight minutes before the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And it's very, very interesting times we live in right now. McCutcheon is going to be argued tomorrow. You know, I said earlier this is Mitch McConnell is going to make a fool of himself by saying I would like to have my, you know, very own billionaire buy me. The actual issues at play are somewhat more subtle than that. Right now, there's an absolute aggregate limit of the number of candidates you can give money to. And if you give money to more than a certain number of candidates, like, you know, 6, 8, 10, 12, something like that, you hit that limit and you can't give it to more politicians. So you couldn't give the maximum donation to every single member of the Republican Party, for example, which is why the Republican Party is the co-litigant along with McCutcheon in this case. It's McCutcheon and the GOP, the Republican Party, versus the Federal Election Commission. So anyhow, just to keep things straight. Boehner says this weekend we're on the path to default. That's a very reassuring message to the rest of the world. Anyhow, you've heard my rants on this. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up? Thanks for listening to KBC.
Hey, Tom. You know, there should be a donut hole in campaign contributions, something like that.
Huh. Yeah.
Sorry, bad joke.
Yeah.
Listen, I disagree with you a little bit about Marbury versus Madison, but we can leave that till later or another time. But I was thinking about the thing that the Republicans want Obama to do is to delay the implementation of the individual mandate as he has done with the corporate mandate on the Affordable Care Act, correct?
Right. And let me tell you, because he delayed the corporate mandate, we're getting screwed. We, meaning my small business. And we had a long conversation with our, Louise did Friday afternoon with our insurance agent. And with Ron, our business manager, and you know, our insurance rates are going up like really, really stiff. And we, if Obama had not delayed the implementation for businesses for a year, then we could buy health insurance on the exchanges, and our rates would be competitive. But right now, we're pretty much, you know, if we want to have any continuity at all for our employees, which would be crazy not to do, we have to stay with the same insurer, and they are just saying rates are going up. and a lot.
The thing is, though, I don't think that Obama has the authority to delay either one.
He does. He does. He absolutely.
How does he have that?
Congress passes laws, and the executive branch executes those laws, and they have a lot of latitude in how they execute those laws. He can decide, you know, a classic example right now. He's decided, although it's illegal to be in the United States if you're not a citizen of the United States, he's decided not to enforce that law with regard to young people.
Correct. Okay, so he's choosing not to enforce. He's choosing not to enforce the corporate mandate on the Affordable Care Act.
That's correct, for a year.
That's what he's doing.
That's right.
Okay, so okay, but at this point,
and there is no mechanism to force him to enforce a law, by the way.
Right. There's nobody is challenging that. The Republicans aren't challenging it because they don't want it to go into effect. The Democrats aren't challenging it because they don't want to cross Obama. And most corporations are not challenging it either. But in terms of the individual mandate, there's a lot of people who want to get on the exchange. And as you just mentioned, you do. So if he were to delay that a year, somebody could sue him and say, you know, you can't do that because you're shutting
me out. You can't sue the president.
Well, you could sue you could take it to court.
No, you can't.
Well, I mean, you could have been taken to court, haven't they, Tom?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could. I don't know how you would, you know, what kind of constitutional construct. Shane, does that? You would have to ask the court to waive sovereign immunity. Yeah, ask the court to waive the government's sovereign immunity. That would be a real stretch, Paul. Typically, the mechanism that our Constitution envisioned and the founders and framers envisioned to resolve these kind of things is called elections.
True.
So, I've got 11 other callers in line here. I do want to keep moving along, but you said you disagree with me on Marbury. How so?
Well, in the sense that John Marshall simply said that what was unconstitutional about the Judiciary Act of 1789 was that it made provisions for things that weren't described in Article 3 of the Constitution, and one of which was that the Supreme Court could hand down writs of mandamus,
right,
which is what it was expected to be the way in which Marbury was to obtain his commission. And
right.
Marshall just simply said, I don't have the authority. You are entitled to your commission, yes, but I don't have the authority to grant that, to make Madison deliver the commission. And so what happened was he said, you filed in the wrong court. Marbury could have gone back to federal court, and so could the other 17 who didn't get their commissions and filed in court, but none of them ever did. So they were entitled to them, and Marshall didn't say that.
Arguably, because if they filed in federal court and lost, it would end up back before John Marshall in the Supreme Court. And the fact of the matter is that if Marbury's argument was that the law was unconstitutional, that was Jefferson's argument. it was Madison's argument. If their argument was that the law was unconstitutional, then the remedy, in my opinion, should not have been judicial. It should have been legislative. They should have put it before they should have encouraged the passage of legislation that would have either amended or repealed the Judiciary Act of, I thought it was 1798, not 89, but whatever.
But at any rate, Marshall's remedy was that if you want to amend the Article 3 of the Constitution, you can do that. But above and beyond that,
because Marshall was asserting his final interpretation of the Constitution, and that does not exist in the Constitution.
Well, that's what makes it an interesting thing. I mean, I'm torn on it because sort of philosophically and theoretically, I just wonder what purpose would the Supreme Court ultimately serve other than another federal court, appellate court or a district court, would they serve it other than to interpret the constitutionality of law?
Well, I'll tell you what the Constitution says about that. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. First of all, you've got to have judicial power that is different from a lot of other courts. So your judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under the Constitution, laws of the United States, treaties, cases
right.
affecting ambassadors, public ministers and consuls, cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, controversies to which the United States is a party, to controversies between two or more states, between
right.
citizens of different states, between states, citizens of the same state claiming land under grants of different states, in all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, and in those in which a state shall be a party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction. In all other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, both
correct,
as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as Congress shall make. That's virtually the entirety of Section 2 of Article 2 of the Constitution that I just read to you. So the Supreme Court handles all those kind of weird cases that no other court logically could handle, like disputes between states or disputes between the United States and England, number one, and, you know, admiralty and maritime law and things like that. And number two, it's the final court of appeals. There has to be a point where the buck stops. You know, if you sue me because my dog ate your chicken, and I countersue you because, you know, my chicken, whatever, and it goes back and forth and back and forth and back and forth from court to court to court to court, there has to be a place where it stops. And the reason I'm using the example, right, of dogs and chickens is because those were the most common cases being adjudicated ultimately by the Supreme Court during the first 50 years of this republic.
And for all those reasons that you mentioned is why Marbury lost his case, because Marshall said that I only have appellate jurisdiction in this kind of case, and you needed to go somewhere else first.
But in order to say that, he said this law cannot stand. He said this law is requiring me to exceed my jurisdiction, so I'm striking down this law. There's a catch-22 built into Marbury.
Yeah, I get it. The mandamus is the writ of mandamus is the part that the Judicial Act said that he needed to have, or he could have.
Right.
But when he read it, the reason Marbury lost his case was because Marshall said that I can only have appellate jurisdiction in this type of case, and
right,
I cannot.
So what he should have done, Paul, is he never should have granted cert to the case in the first place. And I think that we've reached a level of wonk talk here where we've probably lost three quarters of our audience.
yeah.
But might that not have been the simple solution?
Exactly. Why did they even take the case? That is a good question.
Marshall never should have taken the case in the first place. The court should not have granted cert. They should have said, sorry, we can't handle this case because this is a case of constitution of what the Constitution says or whether or not this law is constitutional, and that's a decision for Congress to make.
We are in agreement now.
Okay, great. Paul, thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. Bill in Hendersonville, North Carolina. Hey, Bill. Glitch in Obamacare? Bill? No Bill. Okay, Merritt in Mendota, Illinois. Hey, Merritt, we got a minute. What's up? Thanks for listening to WCPT.
How you doing, Tom? I almost forgot what I was going to talk about from whatever.
It says something about Boehner kowtowing to the Koch brothers.
Yeah, but I wanted to get something better for your whole audience. Do you think these guys are doing this because they're trying to put a bigger bag of stuff on the front porch of the White House because they know Hillary Clinton's going to get in?
You mean as in the old put a bag of stuff there and set it on fire and when the person, you know, the old joke? Yeah. I think that's possible, but I don't think they're that. Actually, no, I don't. I think that what's going on here is the battle between does government serve a positive purpose in our lives, or does government serve a negative purpose in our lives? From the point of view of billionaires in this country, government by and large serves a negative purpose because it taxes and regulates them. From the point of view of average working people, government serves a positive purpose because it provides them with free education, free roads, lots of goodies, and Social Security. And it's which of those two visions is going to win out. That's what the battle is, Merritt. Thank you for
your
call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It really is that simple. All of this opposition to Obamacare has nothing to do with it being a train wreck or not or anything else. It has to do with whether or not government is going to work. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Bill in Henderson, North Carolina. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hey. Sorry I lost you there.
Ah.
First of all, you and I were born 4 days apart in the same year.
Wow. Hello, Taurus.
Well, that tells you my age. I'm on Social Security.
Well, that's interesting. How do you do that at 62?
You just apply.
Oh, you can. Oh, that's right. You're eligible, but you get a lower benefit, right?
Yeah, but anyway, I ran the numbers, and I don't break even until I'm 80.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so people need to do that, and I don't even know if I'm going to live to be 80.
Huh.
Anyway, on the healthcare thing, I went to the Kaiser Foundation calculator.
Right.
And I plugged in my yearly income, And it, I think it's just a glitch in their algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it told me that I would have to pay $8,000 a year for health care with no subsidies available to me.
And your annual income is?
$11,400.
Then you must be in one of those states. Well, you're in North Carolina. You're in one of those states where they chose not to expand Medicare. Normally,
that's true.
Exactly.
That's true, but we do have the the exchanges set up.
No, but here's the problem, Bill. There is a minimum amount for the exchange, right? And if you're poor, I mean, an $11,000 income is below the poverty level. If you're poor, typically you don't even have to go to the exchange. You just get free health insurance via Medicare in those states that took the Medicare money from the federal government. And that covers up to 100
well, wait,
and some
but,
odd.
Are you talking about Medicare or Medicaid?
Medicaid. Thank you for correcting me.
Yeah,
Medicaid.
But they didn't expand Medicaid.
I know, and that's why you would have to pay $8,000 a year for health insurance, even though your income is only $11,000. I don't think it's a glitch. I think that we had this conversation with Wendell Potter on this program last week. There are probably 10 to 15 million people, maybe fewer, but somewhere in that neighborhood. Think Progress came out with a number of 8 million last week, or it was the New York Times actually came out with it last week, 8 million people, who are poor enough that there's no way they can possibly afford the insurance on the exchanges, as you just described. And yet, because the Medicaid expansion, which was supposed to take care of that, which was supposed to fill that in, because the Supreme Court ruled that a state could choose not to take the Medicaid money, those states that are not taking the Medicaid money, these states define their own qualification. In other words, you may in North Carolina, you may have to make less than $8,000, for example. I don't know what the threshold is, but there's a threshold in North Carolina. Every state is different. So let's say it's $8,000 in North Carolina. If the state had taken the Medicaid money, that would be something just short of 200% of the poverty line. So that would mean that, up to 20 some odd thousand dollars a year, you'd get free health insurance that would be paid for by Medicaid. But because the state didn't take the Medicaid money, and you're making more than the amount of money that North Carolina will cover you for under Medicaid, under the state North Carolina Medicaid program, you're in this kind of donut hole where, the horrible donut hole where your only option is either to buy it on the exchange or reduce your income. Do you understand what I'm saying, Bill?
Well, anyway, I've got a 3%. Are you there?
Yeah, hey, we're out of time, though. I'm sorry. We'll have to continue the conversation later. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Victoria.
Hello.
Hello. Always nice to see your smiling face. So what's up?
Well, President Obama made a previously unscheduled trip to FEMA's headquarters in Washington today, where people are furloughed, except the ones, of course, they had to bring back to work because of Midwest storms and what they thought was going to be Hurricane Karen.
Oh, and FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Exactly. And then they had to send them back onto furlough after they helped out.
Once they decided that the hurricane wasn't as bad as they thought it was going to be?
Yeah.
Oh, this is just... This,
so he
this.
Highlighted how ridiculous that was.
Oh, yeah. These guys are, in order to prevent Obamacare succeeding in proving that government can function, they are breaking government even worse. It's nuts.
It's quite something. He also challenged Speaker John Boehner to hold a vote on a clean government funding bill. He said that if John Boehner and his colleagues are saying there aren't enough votes, then they should prove it. He said the truth of the matter is there are enough Republican and Democratic votes in the House right now to end the shutdown immediately. The House should hold that vote today. He said it was his strong suspicion. He also said that he thought that Boehner hasn't brought the clean continuing resolution to the House floor because he apparently doesn't want to see the government shutdown end at the moment unless he's able to extract concessions.
Right. The way that I think this is going to play out, and I might be very, very wrong on this, but I'm increasingly thinking that this CR, which is,
debt ceiling?
No, there's a motion to put a bill on the floor of the House without...
Discharge petition?
The discharge petition, thank you, bless you. That this discharge petition that is ripening right now and that can only be dropped on the 14th, on that one day, 3 days before the debt ceiling explodes, that discharge petition is going to hit the floor of the House of Representatives on the 14th, and it will have enough signatures to pass, and it will pass a clean CR to fund the government, and it will pass a raise in the debt ceiling. And Boehner will then be able to step out of the way of the explosion and not have egg or debris or shrapnel on his face. And the few rational Republicans who the Chamber of Commerce has now come out and said, we will fund your reelection campaigns against the billionaire Tea Partiers, those few rational Republicans who sign on to that discharge petition will have cover. The Chamber of Commerce all but said that this weekend. And the Democrats, of course, you know, they're fine with all of this all along. What do you think?
Well, I think that if they've calculated correctly, that could happen. I saw a couple of stories over the weekend saying that it's possible that the Democrats had misread the rule on the discharge petition.
Oh, no.
And that the 14th might not be the date, and they might not be able to hold the vote until well into the 20s.
Which means we default.
Exactly. It was a story in Politico about 2 days ago.
I'll have to track it down. If you have an easy link to it, email it to me.
I'll see if I can find it. Yeah,
I'm trying to keep up on this. Okay, well, so much for that theory. Then what is it going to, you know, as far as I can tell, the president's right. Boehner
does
have...
the stock market's below 15,000 today, and an aggregate of the Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ has them down nearly a point. So that's not good.
Yeah, you mean nearly a percentage.
Nearly a percentage point, correct.
Yeah.
Nearly a percentage point between the three. Not quite, they're in the 90s, but nearly a percentage point. And that's been growing during the day. I've been watching it. They were like half a percentage point, and they've...
Oh, it's going to grow day by day. I mean, if I was doing day trading, I almost did on Saturday. I almost, you know, just for the hell of it, said, oh, let's take $500 or $1,000. I mean, I play with little amounts of money, but, you know, big guys play with it. And buy VXX, you know, buy that. It's a triple bet against the market. So every point the market goes down, VXX goes up 3 points. And I remember, you know, when the market crashed, I had a friend. I was at Clear Channel out in Portland, and I had a friend who had bought VXX, which is a hedge against the market. And it had gone from being worth $22 to being worth over $100 in like 4 days or something. I mean, it's like, whoa. Anyway.
I think that's the kind of thing, you know, despite Ted Yoho, who said that he thinks that a default could stabilize the markets, which I thought was okay. But that's Ted Yoho for you, you know.
Yoho is his real name. You're not making fun of Ted.
No, I'm really not. It's okay. Either Ho-Yo or Yoho.
Okay.
It really is.
Yeah,
because you want to say Yo-Yo, but it's really Yoho.
Okay.
Really is. He's a former large animal veterinarian.
And he's a member of Congress from where?
Florida. He has pictures of cows in his office.
Republican from Florida. Okay.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Can't make that stuff up, Tom.
I figured. I know you don't make things up, Victoria.
Can't
I know that.
Can't make that up.
So what else is going on in the world?
Secretary of State John Kerry is facing backlash for comments he made earlier today in Bali at a joint press conference with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, when he said that Bashar Assad of Syria deserved credit for complying rapidly with a UN resolution demanding his regime turn over its chemical weapons to the international community.
Well, when you demand somebody does something and they do it, how can you not say, well, good on you?
Turkish President Erdogan slammed him. Huh. How can we praise someone who has killed 110,000 people, Erdogan said today. It doesn't matter if these people were killed with chemical weapons or with other weapons. In the end, they were killed.
Yeah. Well, there is that.
Okay. State Department scrambled, saying all of our positions on Bashar Assad have not changed, period, full stop.
Yeah. Okay. By the way, to what extent are countries in the Pacific Rim viewing the lack of the president of President Obama at this event, and he's not there because of this government shutdown. To what extent are they viewing that as a sign of weakness or, feebleness by the United States?
China is ruling the event.
China is ruling. So by closing the House, by closing government, the Republicans in the House have handed the world economy to China.
Correct.
Amazing. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, we the people are supposed to have the power in America. That's why the first three words of the Constitution are we the people. It's like we're in charge. We're establishing this for us. That was the idea of the founders. And it has been taken from us. Since the Reagan Revolution, we've become the land of kings, warlords, and theocrats. Let me explain. As Thomas Jefferson pointed out, from the founding of Samaria 7,000 years ago until 1776, one of three types of people and groups pretty much ruled everyone else. They were the hereditary kings, the violent warlords, or the theocrats. And they justified these forms of tyranny by saying that the people could not rule themselves. Instead, they had to be ruled by somebody else. One of the biggest believers in this was Thomas Hobbes back in 1634 in Leviathan. He said, humans are by nature evil, and that life without the iron fist of church or state would be, quote, war of every man against every man, resulting in a society where life is poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Kings, warlords, and theocrats had rights. And they granted privileges to the people. Jefferson and the revolutionaries of 1776 came along and flipped this power structure on its head. We the people, they said, are in charge of ruling. We don't need no kings. We don't need no theocrats. We don't need, theocracy is a dangerous and flawed system. And we must be so vigilant about warlords arising in America that our Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, read it yourself with your own eyes. Our Constitution explicitly says that the Army of the United States cannot exist any longer than 2 years without oversight and renewed appropriation from Congress. When Jefferson took power from the kings and the warlords and the theocrats and gave it to the people, he said, I know of no safe depository of the ultimate powers of the society, but the people themselves. About theocracy, Jefferson told Alexander von Humboldt that, quote, history, I believe, furnishes no example of a priest-ridden people maintaining a free civil government. This marks the lowest grade of ignorance of which their civil as well as religious leaders will always avail themselves for their own purposes. End of quote. So thanks to Jefferson and our founding fathers, the power structure that existed for thousands of years theocrats, kings, warlords on the top, people on the bottom, was flipped upside down so that the people had rights and could decide which privileges they would give to the hereditary kings, warlords, and would-be theocrats. This new power structure worked pretty good for about 200 years. People in charge, rich people, yeah, hey, doing what the rest of us say. Got to pay 91% income tax, right? Theocrats, the churches, you know, they didn't even have basically an income tax exemption until the 60s. But beginning in 1981 with the Reagan Revolution, the hereditary kings, the violent warlords, and I know you're scratching your head right now going, the violent warlords? I'll get to it. The hereditary kings, the violent warlords, and the theocrats began reclaiming the power that they once had in other lands. They began reclaiming it here. Well, the theocrats had it in Massachusetts at the founding of this country. You know, from the beginning of the pilgrims until the country was founded. But now these three groups, they're making deals with each other to suppress the power of we the people, to take away our rights. So here's who they are. Today's hereditary kings are the wealthy elite, the top 1% of Americans who control a staggering 43% of our nation's wealth. And they continually fight inheritance taxes so their children can take over their wealth and maintain their dynasties. These are hereditary kingdoms or royal families, right? Meanwhile, America's modern-day hereditary kings are conspiring with today's theocrats. Megachurches, particularly in the South, have become major power centers and organizing forces for the hereditary kings to spread their ideas and messages and to grow their dynasties. For example, prosperity theology teaches that you are rich because God made you that way. Well, if that's the case, logical flip side, if you're poor, God made you that way. This is how the theocrats justify the existence of the plutocrats and the poor people. But even with the help of the theocrats, the hereditary kings couldn't continue to get richer and richer and richer without the help of the violent warlords, which we refer to today as the military-industrial complex. The military-industrial complex takes up nearly half of the entire U.S. budget every year, with much of it being privatized, and the profits, therefore, going to the billionaires, also known as the hereditary kings, and their defense corporations. You see how this is coming together? The Founding Fathers never envisioned this return to the brute and dictatorial power structure that basically for, you know, 7,000 years dominated the globe, stripping rights from people and giving them to kings and warlords and theocrats. More importantly, it's fundamentally undemocratic. We are on the verge of some really serious decisions that we need to make here in this country about a return to the core values that this nation was built on. Do we break up these hereditary ruling families by aggressively establishing and enforcing inheritance taxes on great wealth? Do we break up the theocracy by taking away tax-exempt status of churches and doing away with government subsidies? And do we break up the out-of-control military-industrial complex? I mean, we could do it. Right? Increase transparency, shut down the revolving door here in Washington, D.C., enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act, and all privatization of traditional government functions. I think we should. I think that kings, warlords, and theocrats, the three great threats to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness identified by Thomas Jefferson 250 years ago, I think these three groups have no place in America. We need to give them the boot. We need to take back our rights and put power back in the hands of people. If America is to survive as America, think about this. If we are to survive as the nation that we were envisioned as, now, obviously not the nation that we started out as, right? We had slavery, we had disenfranchisement of women. It was far from perfect. But the vision was clearly articulated. If America is to survive as a we the people, the nation, as opposed to me, the rich guy, we, the people, then we, the people, have to stand up and restore the core values that Jefferson and the founders put into place. We have to say enough already. The Walton family, six people, control more wealth than a third of the entire country, the United States. You know, you can be rich and pass it down to your children, but a third of the wealth of the entire country? At what point do you say enough is enough? We have this nobillionaires.com website. Let's place 100% tax on all wealth, not income, wealth, above $1 billion. You can be a billionaire in real terms, but not a multi-billionaire, because it's not good for society. Because there is, I will grant you, an economy is not a total zero-sum game, but there is a certain amount of zero-sum to it. There is a certain amount of when Johnny takes all the toys, all the other kids don't have any toys. There is a certain amount of that. It's real.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, and how do we go about doing that when the Supreme Court continuously, and tomorrow they're going to argue it again in McCutcheon, continuously says, oh, yeah, the rich guys, sure, they have more power. Welcome back, Debbie, in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Hey, Debbie, what's up?
Hi.
Hi.
Well, first, since we're going to throw theology around in politics, I got to say that Jesus Christ, he chose his disciples from among the poor.
Well, or they were the working class. I mean, Matthew was a tax collector.
Yeah.
I don't remember
and
Luke was a physician. Luke was a doctor. He was maybe the upper middle class of his day.
Yeah.
But Peter was a fisherman.
Doctor has to live within his means.
Pardon?
But anyway, I had called in about the conversation that you were having with Nick Gillespie, I think his name was. We were talking about the need for the social safety net, and
oh, yeah.
He was talking about maybe loosening up the regulations a little bit.
Yeah.
And I'm in my late 40s, and I've been meeting these social programs at various different times off and on throughout my life. And I actually like the spending regulations. You know, they can't buy tobacco and pet food and booze and so on. I'm okay with all of that. But
let me just, Debbie, if I may interrupt you for just a second, just for our listeners who don't know what you're talking about. What Nick suggested was that the food stamp program and the WIC programs and the other, you know, food assistance programs, that instead of saying, here's some money, but you can only use it to buy healthy food, you can't buy booze, you can't buy tobacco, you can't buy junk food, and you can't buy cat food, instead we should just give people money. And I said, I think that's a very bad idea because, you know, some small percentage of people will use that money to buy crazy things, and Fox News will video it, and all of a sudden there'll be an outcry, and there won't be any money anymore. And, of course, that's why he's suggesting it. You know, he wants to just do away with the whole thing. Back to you.
Well, we need the safety net, and, you know, we actually need to enlarge it, you know, like with the Medicare. You know, that's like a reoccurring dream.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it keeps coming up, and it's never really happening. And, you know, Internet is something else that needs to be included in that. But we do need it, and we have to strengthen it. But, you know, we're very vulnerable out here, these people that are poor. And it's downright abusive to have to keep telling people, just about everybody I meet at Hello, I have to say I don't have money. No, I don't have the $5 to pay for parking. No, I can't just buy a meal right now. No. You know, I can't do this, I can't do that, to the point where I don't even want to go out anymore because I have to keep reaffirming this negative. Then I'd like to move out of this hole and not keep reaffirming this negative. It's downright abusive. And, you know, when you apply for these social services, you have to completely open up your life to them. You have to take your checkbook, passbook to them and let they go through it, and they read through your expenditures, and they'll ask you to even explain these things. You have to completely open up your life to them to apply for these services that are, you know, life-saving and very necessary.
Yeah.
And, you know, I even had a caseworker once who
set up a phony account, a cash account in my name, and then they tried to come back on me. You know, she spent the money, had a nice spending trip, and then they came back on me and tried to tell me that I had spent their
Debbie, money. Debbie, you are the living proof of when Franklin Roosevelt said, a necessitous man is not a free man. A poor person is not a free person. You are the living proof of that, and thank you for articulating it so clearly. Thank you much. I wish you the very best. Thanks for watching. We'll be back. Okay, VXX is selling at $16 right now. $16.21. It's up $1.15 for the day. I should have bought it yesterday. Well, actually, probably the trade would have executed today, and I would have gotten screwed. So you got to be a stockbroker. You got to know the inside. You can't just, have one of these E-Trade accounts or something. It's like, or have a broker and call them up and say, would you please do this? Well, yeah, I'll get around to it after, I've dealt with a millionaire's money. Robert in Portland, Oregon. You wanted to disagree about Thomas? Actually, his first name was Robert, but people call him Thomas Hobbs.
Well, I do. I was being facetious a little bit, but I was calling about Jefferson because his letter to George White back in 1786, he pointed out that the most important code law is diffusement of knowledge among the people. Because without that, people will be oppressed with the evils he calls out, tyranny, oppression, etc. And the tax that we're going to pay for the education is 1,000th the tax or the amount that we'll pay to the priests, noblemen, that will rise up if the people aren't educated. And that's what's happened.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And in fact, that was the second half of the one Jefferson quote that I read just a few minutes ago, let's see if I've got it here. I don't have it in front of me anymore. I'm sorry. But basically he said that, I know of no other, prescription than for the power to be with the people themselves. And then he went on to say, and when the people lose their way, the remedy is not to take the power from them, but to educate them.
So what I'm saying is the swamp of uneducated, ignorant, and even misinformed people, that's the swamp that allows for teabaggers to exist. So we have to drain those swamps or else we're never going to get ahead.
Right, and you drain that swamp by fully funding public education, including post-secondary education.
Yes. Reagan had it. Back to Reagan again. When he eliminated the free education in California, that should have tipped everybody off to this guy's game. And, you've seen the results.
It did tip a lot of us off. I'll tell you. It did tip a lot of us off. And when he called, the day before or the day after Kent State, when he called the college students punks, that tipped a lot of us off too. Reagan was no friend of students at the very least. Robert, thank you for the, hang on just a second here before I drop you. What is it that we disagree about with regard to Thomas Hobbes?
Oh, I'm just saying that if look at what's happened.
That we're turning into a Hobbesian society?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Right. Yeah, Hobbes could have been right in the presence of what we call civilization and the absence of education. Hobbes could have been right. And, yes, I actually agree with you on that. Thank you, Robert. Deborah in Framingham, Mass. Hey, Deborah.
Hello, I'm actually from District 12, and I think our government has abdicated, surrendered, and left a vacuum that needs to be occupied, and if we don't do it now, I don't see that we're going to have too many more chances of peacefully taking back or making a new government.
Well, I think the time to do it, Deborah, is, there's some small elections. The governorship of Virginia, for example, is, coming up in a month or so. But the first Tuesday in November, as I recall. But I think that the big opportunity is going to be roughly 13 months from now in November of 2014. And if in that midterm election the billionaires and the Tea Partiers win, then we are headed for probably the biggest crash this country has ever seen. And if they lose, we might be able to pull the fat out of the fire. But we'll see.
You introduced me to the book by Altemeyer about the authoritarians.
Yes.
And I'll tell you why we need to do something, whatever, and I'm certainly not the wisest person in the room, but there was a part in his book that gave me an absolute chill, and I think he identified the face of evil. And that's why we can't just let this continue. Do you remember when he divided his class, his students into two sections and they had war games?
Yes.
And the high-scoring authoritarians destroyed the world. I mean, they'd start out like trading grain and blah, blah, blah. And at the end of the game, they destroyed the world consistently. So he would say to them, let me give you another chance. And they destroyed the world again.
Right.
And that's...
And they're doing it right now.
So chilling. Doesn't that tell us that there is something... that we have to take care of?
I think so. I think it does. And that's why I wrote The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, which is a book about that topic, about how we have to reboot our culture. We have to change our culture. And the high-functioning authoritarians, and in particular the sociopathic high-functioning authoritarians in our society, which are the people like Paul Ryan and John Boehner, although I think he's probably more of a high-functioning alcoholic to be speaker, you'd have to be a pretty authoritarian. But these guys who hold up Ayn Rand, who herself was clearly a sociopath, and hold this as the ideal. I mean, she held up William Edward Hickman, who not only was a sociopath, but murdered a 12-year-old girl, and when her father paid a ransom for her, he threw her dismembered parts at the car at her father. That was the prototype for Ayn Rand's heroes. And this is grim stuff. This is serious stuff, Deborah. And you're right. The concept of authoritarians and the concept in particular of sociopathic authoritarians, they will destroy the world. They are destroying the world. And with global warming. In fact, we've got a movie coming out tomorrow about this, and I'll be talking about that all day tomorrow. So, Deborah, thank you for the call. I'm going to have to go back and read The Authoritarians again. It's been a decade, I think. 28 minutes past the hour, and John, John Dean wrote a book called Conservatives Without a Conscience that was kind of based on the authoritarians, which is really worth reading, too. 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, sedition. If John Boehner and the Republicans are committing sedition, we don't have laws against it right now, should we? And the very, very proboeutically ugly, the good, Hector Marquez. The Albuquerque, New Mexico police officer has received a special award for how he responded to a call in September. While checking up on a call about a domestic dispute, Officer Marquez learned that the woman whose house he was at was a grandmother raising 6 grandchildren all on her own. What he did next was truly remarkable. Check it out.
I don't know how we got onto the topic about the welfare of the kids and if she needed anything. She had told me something about that they had last eaten in the morning. Grandma had made pancakes, but she couldn't get her food stamps till the 19th, which was 8 days away.
It was dinner time, so Officer Marquez used his own money and made a quick trip to the grocery store.
He got the milk, bread, eggs, sandwich meat, and snacks for the kids. Just his way, he says, of looking out for them and Grandma.
I think it's safe to say that Officer Marquez truly is a good guy with a gun. The bad. Fox so-called news. During a weekend broadcast of Fox and Friends, host Anna Kuhlman brought up what seemed like a pretty explosive revelation. President Obama has offered to pay out of his own pocket to keep the Museum of Muslim Culture open during the shutdown while doing nothing to reopen the World War II Memorial in the National Mall in Washington. Check this one out.
it really doesn't seem fair, especially we're going to talk a little bit later in the show, too, about, you know, some things that are continuing to be funded. And President Obama has offered to pay out of his own pocket for the Museum of Muslim Culture out of his own pocket.
It sounds pretty bad, right? Here's the problem. The story that Kuhlman was referencing was put out by the National Report. It's a joke website similar to The Onion. It's completely bogus. You know, the sad thing is that Kuhlman's producers probably knew the story was a joke all along, but didn't care because it fits in with Fox's race-baiting anti-Obama agenda. And the very, very ugly, the California Republican Party. Visitors at the Golden State GOP convention this weekend had the opportunity to do all sorts of interesting things. Listen to the party's rising stars speaking about their strategy for the upcoming year, meet Texas Governor Rick Perry, and get buttons labeled KFC Hillary Special, too fat thighs, too small breasts, left wing. So much for attracting women voters, right? To its credit, the California Republican Party did remove the buttons from the convention center, but the disturbing part is that they were there in the first place. No one would ever make such offensive jokes about any one of the GOP's white male superstars, or female for that matter. And that is just very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. Karen in Los Angeles. Hey, Karen. What's up?
Hey, Tom. First of all, I have to compliment you on your cool and calm demeanor, and I hope someday you'll let your listeners know how you your secret, how you do that, but that's for another time. But okay. I really appreciate your cool and calm demeanor. I'm here to talk about Obamacare, but specifically what really troubles me is that we're not getting into specifics, and that's why I think people aren't getting it. I used to work for the Schwarzenegger administration, and a lot of people don't realize that here in California, we had tried to push through something like Obamacare years ago, and we had found, the research found that it was a tremendous drag on the economy, not having health care, and also that about 50%, almost 50% of people who filed for bankruptcy was due because of medical costs.
Right.
And this was before the housing crash.
Right.
So now we have the housing crash and a lot more people unemployed. But the specifics I want to talk about is I broke my ankle, and it cost $50,000. That was the hospital bill. My cousin had a heart attack. The bill was $200,000. And I think we need to start talking about the actual cost to people who don't have health care. If you are an unemployed middle-class person, it will cost you $1,000 to $1,200 a month to have coverage. And if you're unemployed, you're only collecting maybe $1,800 a month for a short period of time. So you have $1,000 for health care.
You're talking about right now before Obamacare kicks in.
Well, yeah, I don't know what it will cost. I didn't do the math on what it will cost after Obamacare.
After Obamacare, it will depend on which state you live. Because if you live in one of the states where they took the Medicaid expansion, and you're living on that kind of an income, you will get health insurance for free. If you're living in one of the states that did not take the Medicaid expansion, you can buy exchanges, but it'll cost a fortune, except that Obamacare has a provision that says that you can't pay more than 9%, I think it is, of your total income for health care. So you do get some kind of a subsidy, even if there's not a Medicare expansion. So, that's the problem. You know, we've done two entire hours in the last 2 weeks, Karen, where we had Victor Volsky and Igor Volsky, and Wendell Potter, yeah. Obamacare experts on just answering people's questions. And I'm through that process, I'm starting to figure out some of the minutia and detail of it. But it is a complex plan because it involves, you know, for-profit insurance companies and a wide variety of different people with different conditions. I think we should have just said the age for eligibility for Medicare is now zero.
Yes.
I mean, it's single payer, right? National single payer tomorrow morning. It could have been done. It could have been done easily. It could have been done fast. But, you know, obviously no Republican would ever vote for it. They want to do away with Social Security. Excuse me, not Social Security, Medicare. They want to do away with Medicare.
Security, too.
Yeah. I think the eligibility age for Social Security should be dropped to 55. And I make a case for that in my book, Rebooting the American Dream, that if you drop the Social Security, and because we've seen this actually been done in several European countries, you drop the retirement age, and what happens is only a small proportion, typically about a third, of the people eligible to retire actually retire, and they're the people who just don't like their jobs. And right. the you know, but enough of the, so A, it doesn't radically increase the costs to the system. But B, what it does is those people who do retire open up all these job openings, and it tightens the labor market. You tighten the labor market, it makes it easier for young people to get a job. Although, you know, so now you've got young people more easily getting into the labor market, and it also causes employers to have to start competing with each other for employees, which bids up the price of labor. As you bid up the price of labor, along with the rising price of labor comes rising taxes and a tax revenue to the government. That rising tax revenue to the government pays for the cost of lowering the retirement age. The math actually works out if you do it around 55.
Well, the whole point, though, is Obamacare is good for the economy.
Yes.
I don't understand when, if you don't have Obamacare, see, for me, it's Obamacare or no Obamacare. And the Republicans are saying they don't want Obamacare because it's going to be a drag on the economy.
No.
And clearly,
well, there-
it has...
They're saying that, but that's a lie. The reason that they don't want Obamacare is that they are dancing to the tune of the billionaires. The billionaires don't need Social Security, so they don't want all the rest of us to have it. They don't want to pay for it. They don't need Medicare, so they don't want the rest of us to have it. They don't want to pay for it. They don't need food stamps, so they don't want the rest of us to have it because they don't want to pay for it. They don't need, frankly, public education, so they don't want the rest of us to have it because they don't want to pay for it. And, you know, the list goes on and on. They don't need national parks, so they don't want the rest of us to have it. So they don't want to pay for it. They don't want to pay for anything except maybe an army. And so if they can convince us that government doesn't function, we will vote for politicians who will start cutting those programs. And if they can't convince us the government is bad, if instead Obama convinces us by having Obamacare be successful, if Obama succeeds in convincing us that government can be good and can actually do something useful, then we start electing politicians who are going to strengthen and expand the power of government in its capacity to do good, right? Because the capacity to do good is now established. And that means that the billionaires are going to have to pay more taxes and their businesses are going to be more heavily regulated, particularly those in the pulp paper industry, those in the oil industry, and those in the banking industry, which constitute, I'd say, 85 to 90%, add gambling in there with Shelley Adelson, probably over 95% of the billionaires who are funding the Tea Party right now. Am I making sense?
You're making absolute sense. And I challenge you to be less esoteric because your viewers are totally on your level. I'm talking about keeping it simple for the average person when they say Obamacare is bad and you say, hey, look, if you fall down and break your leg, it's $50,000. Do you have that? Because that's what you're going to pay for. I think you might be able to get through their thick heads.
Yeah, good point. And you just did, Karen. And you're right. Although, on the other hand, you know, with – like, for example, the arguments with Nick Gillespie, I think that there is something to be said for 30,000-foot philosophical arguments, because I think that all of these small arguments that we're having right now about the debt ceiling and about funding government and about Obamacare and everything else, they all are the consequence of that 30,000-foot argument, and we need to have that. By the way, the reason that I don't blow up at these right-wingers is because of my father. My father was a very active Republican throughout my teenage years. In fact, I walked door to door with him in 1964 for Barry Goldwater. I went to a John Birch Society meeting with him in 1964. I was 13 years old. I'd read John Starmer's None Dare Call It Treason. I was terrified of the communists. Within 2 years of that, I was 16 years old. I was at Michigan State University and I was getting tear gassed in an anti-war protest. Maybe 3 years. And my father and I, from that point forward, after I left home, until the day he died in 2006, we argued politics constantly. It was the principal form of communication that we had. And I learned how to have a really, really, really good fight with a really, really smart Republican and conservative and still love him, even though I completely disagreed with his worldview. So, Karen, thank you for the call. And I hope more people can do that, too.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
One of my goals with this program, and one of the reasons that I debate these conservatives, is not only to highlight the issues, but also to model a way of... because we all have these people in our lives, right? And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Doug in Jamul, California. Hey, Doug, I am mixed up about what the Constitution means.
Yeah, of course you are. I love it when you go on your Marxist rants and you start going on these rants and these rabbles about we the people and phony baloney democracy, because we're never intended to be a democracy, and you know that full well. And you know Jefferson was in the ambassador to France, so he had little to no influence on the Constitutional Convention.
He,
representatives, our representatives.
Doug, wait a second. You can't just do a serial chain of things that are not factually true and not expect to be rebutted on them. Jefferson was constantly corresponding with Madison, who was in the Constitutional Convention. Jefferson was the first person to see the first draft of the Constitution, in fact, or one of the very first people. Jefferson led the revolt against the Constitution that nearly brought it down, and the consequence of that was that the Bill of Rights got written at the, you know, before the Constitution was put forward for ratification in 1791. Yes, he was not our ambassador to France. He was our emissary is not the right word. There was another word for it, but he was our representative to France. Yes, during that time. But he, you know, when the Constitutional Convention, he certainly signed that, and he did envision a small D democracy. The word democracy and the word republic were not separated from each other until 1787 by James Madison in the Federalist Papers, and it was purely to help promote the Constitution. It was to make a political point. Back to you,
Doug. Correct. A political point to say that we are not a democracy, where your phony baloney 51% of the vote and Congress and the government can force us to do whatever
Doug, then
we
why
want.
Is the
force
president the president?
Obamacare. Force. More laws, more force. Your sedition.
Okay.
Your rebellion.
Doug, what's your, if you don't like a form of government where 51% of the people can elect somebody who can pass a law, and laws do involve force. Laws are enforced by guys with guns, no doubt about it. If you don't like a system where majority rules, what's your alternative?
It's majority rule was never supposed to be the alternative. You're going to roughshod. You're supporting the system right now with Obamacare that roughshods over my constitutional rights and forces people to go into Obamacare, forces people into these phony baloney laws. We have more criminals in frickin' prison than China has. That's your democracy.
The person having the greatest number of votes shall be the president. If such number be a minority, the whole number of electors appointed, or if there be more than one who shall have such a majority and have an equal number of votes, then the House of Representatives shall choose. It says right in the Constitution that the president's elected by the majority. What's your alternative to majority win?
Do you know how you're missing the point? You're missing the point because you have to respect the Bill of Rights and our Constitution.
Where in the
rights.
Bill of Rights does it say that the majority doesn't
51%.
Win?
Do you understand that? You don't seem to understand.
What's your
that.
Alternative,
you
can, Doug? You call me a Marxist. What's your alternative?
Honor your oath of office. That's what you do to the written, intended, and ratified amendments of the Constitution, not make them up as you go like you're doing. You know, there's no.
I'm not an elected official, Doug.
Thank God.
Well, okay. I guess we're clear on our positions. I agree with you, Bax, by the way. Thank God I'm not an elected official. I would not want to be one. I frankly don't have the courage to be an elected official. I have a lot of respect for many of those people who are willing to go through that sausage grinder to become an elected official. We'll be back. Welcome back, Tom. I've been here with you and George in Eureka, California. Hey, George, what's on your mind today?
Wow. Thank you very much. Ronald Reagan and the voters' rights. One of the interesting things, and thank God you have a internet thing there with people that can look this up. Last week on PBS, there was a gentleman from apparently the Ronald Reagan administration who stated that one of the aspects they've been trying to do is correct the last 100 years plus of destroying our nation by having graduated income tax, by having the Social Security put out by rubber legs, the rest of the progressive stuff.
Yeah, they're not just trying to undo the New Deal. They want to go all the way back to 1900 and undo the...
room can find that from last week's public broadcasting. And I think that the kind of things that you repeatedly show politicians in their own words trying to do things that the right wing really needs to hear and react to so that we can keep going.
Yeah.
The other aspect of the Colorado voter recall, those two people that were recalled mm-hmm. were recalled with 13% of the votes.
Right.
13% of the people voted
right.
to recall them. I didn't say it right again.
13% of the people voted in the election in which they were recalled, and one of them was...
were the ones who voted to remove them. So 7% of the Colorado voters got rid of the two decent politicians.
Yeah, two state senators. Yeah, I am with you. And that's the tragedy of these non-presidential elections. And that's and you know, George, the main reason that they were able to pull that off was because the Republican Party filed for and got a court order forbidding vote by mail. And so that drove that voter participation down radically. And one of those guys lost by just, what, a few hundred votes, not even. It was pretty amazing. It was pretty pathetic, actually. So anyhow, thanks for the call. Rick in Chicago. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hey, how are you?
Good.
This is a great show. It's the first time I've ever listened. Hey, I'm a conservative, and actually I was listening the last 10, 15 minutes to your comments regarding, just really the Democrat point of view, Obamacare and the government shutdown. And we can pick any of the topics, but maybe if we just stick with Obamacare, what I don't appreciate, and I have an issue with, is the way you couch it. It's people like myself either want everything or nothing. I don't feel that that's really fair. It's not that just because we don't want the law that was passed that we don't want to provide care for people. We just don't think that this is the best way to go about it.
So what's your alternative? The Republicans have not, to the best of my knowledge, offered an alternative other than health savings accounts, which doesn't work for people who don't have enough money.
I don't know. Well, the Republicans have, but I don't really know.
What is your alternative, Rick?
Yeah. What's that?
You have 46 million people in the United States without health insurance. If any of them gets sick or gets in a car accident, either it breaks them totally for the rest of their lives and probably wipes out their families, or economically, or you and I are paying for it. That's a highly dysfunctional system, just looking at it from an economic perspective, setting aside the obvious moral issues. What's your alternative?
We agree 100% on that. So the question, though, is, to me, the problem is because HMOs are the way they are, people are not informed with how much health care costs. And going to a single payer or going to Obamacare, it doesn't address that.
Obamacare is not a single payer.
Well, I know it's not yet, but I don't want to debate whether it's a good idea or not. My point is, all it does is it provides insurance to other people, but it doesn't lower the cost of health care. And by the way, it actually doesn't provide access to care.
Rick, if you believe in the so-called free market, then you would, I think, have to acknowledge that if demand for something goes up, entrepreneurs are going to step in and meet that demand, which means that access to health care will be expanded when demand for health care increases.
Under Obamacare, the federal government and a small group of people get to decide what the right prices are. It's not a free market.
No, they don't. It absolutely is. The health insurance companies can no longer take more than 20% off the top. That's the rule. They used to be able to take whatever they wanted off the top. You had health insurance companies taking 40% off the top. You got health insurance CEOs taking over $1 billion in there.
Right. Comparing, and I agree. I think that it's completely broken. But I just don't.
But we've been trying the Republican way for a couple of centuries.
It's not the Republican way.
Yeah, the Republican way is leave it totally to the for-profit marketplace. You know, in Switzerland, which does not have a government health insurance program, it's the only European country in which the government plays no role in health care. In Switzerland, the government actually does two things. You are required to have health insurance. You are required to. If you don't, you get a substantial tax penalty. I mean, a substantial one. You're required to. And secondly, all the health providers, the health care providers, the hospitals, the health insurance providers have to be not-for-profit. If you set up a for-profit operation in Switzerland, you go to jail. And in Switzerland, they've got one of the best healthcare systems in the world. It's a totally market-based system, but it's a not-for-profit market-based system. And this
is... Here, mark my words. What we're going to end up with this is two different healthcare systems. We're going to have a public healthcare system, just like in the UK, and we're going to have a private healthcare system.
I agree with you. I agree with you.
How is that good?
Because there is a public health care system, because right now there isn't. What we've got is the emergency rooms that Ronald Reagan signed into law in 1986. That doesn't benefit anybody.
Can't afford the best care is going to go to the people. It's going to create a greater divide than what we have.
No, I agree. You're absolutely right, and that is something that we should be addressing. But let's start with taking care of those 46 million people who are not insured. Let's create a public system, even if it's not the best system. Medicare is the best system. Medicaid is not the best system. But let's begin, right? As Kennedy said in his first inaugural, you know, it may take a year, it may take a day, a thousand days, whatever. But let us begin. So coming up tomorrow, everything you need to know about the eighth day of our government shutdown, plus a surprise for all our listeners and viewers that you're going to have to tune in to find out about. And will Obamacare be Waterloo or the Panama Canal for conservatives? I'll challenge conservative Richard Viguerie. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It starts with you. Get out there, get active, tag your it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.